From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now, here's your host, Mark Kepler.
The state's total education budget will likely be over $70 billion next fiscal year, up a whopping 50% since 2011. California now spends $3,800 more per child than it did during the depths of the Great Recession. That's $14,500 per student this year, compared to about $10,700 in 2011. So why is California still near the bottom in per-pupil spending among states? And why are educators saying they'll have difficulty balancing their budgets going forward? We'll ask Judy Lind, a reporter with Cal Matters, who's written extensively on the price of K-12 education in California.
We'll also hear from Dr. Todd Odo, superintendent of Visalia Unified School District, and Michael Johnston, associate superintendent of administrative services for the Clovis Unified School District.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive from the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute. It's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Recently, Cal Matters, a nonprofit, nonpartisan media venture that explains California's politics and policies, ran a series on the price of education. We're fortunate to have the reporter who wrote that series, Judy Lind. Oh, welcome to the Matty Report.
Thank you for having me.
So the last few years, it seems like public schools have been big winners in the governor's annual budget. How big?
They're big winners because we have an increasingly improving economy. We've seen an infusion of extra taxes from Proposition 30, and that's meant that...
That Proposition 30 was the temporary tax that's going to be supposedly phased out.
Yes, yes. Okay. That was approved by voters in 2012, mm-hmm. and Jerry Brown campaigned for it. And now our this year's school budget is $71.6 billion. That's a 50% increase.
Wow.
From 2011.
That's a big jump. I got a lot of school districts are very happy to see that, I'm sure.
Yes.
And that also means that the per pupil spending has increased quite a bit as well. I was reading your articles. You said that it's increased by $3,800
yeah.
per pupil. That's a lot of money. So it wasn't that long ago that school districts were handing out pink slips. It seems that situation has completely reversed itself. What impact are these bigger budgets having on teacher pay?
They're going up. In short, their schools that once handed out tens of thousands of pink slips are now trying to lure teachers with bonuses, pay bonuses. They're getting increases in merit raises and trying to make sure that their staff is now that can be rebuilt.
Yeah, because they let these people go, and now they say, gee, we have this need. And my understanding is that the salary has gone up 10.6% in the last 6 years. Now, that sounds kind of good, but that's actually lower than the rate of inflation. And so, yes, but.
Yes.
So how do California's teachers' salaries rank when you're taking a look at teacher salaries nationwide?
We're very much in the top tier. Our average salary, according to the Department of Education, is about $74,000. And if you look at that, that puts us in with New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts. That, you know, that's a high cost area region, and that's what we need to stay competitive.
Is that really what's driving this? That California, most areas of the state, is pretty high cost of living. $74,000 sounds like a lot, but you know, in some places it's difficult to survive on that. Is that what's driving these higher salaries in California?
Very much so. You know, you look at the Bay Area, San Francisco in particular, $74,000 of an average teacher salary may not get you the best housing or in a safe neighborhood.
You know, it's interesting. I have a friend whose children live in San Francisco, and, you know, they're living downtown, $4,000 a month in rent. So you start thinking about these $50,000 you're spending just on rent alone. $74,000 doesn't go very far in a place like the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about California compared to other states in terms of per pupil spending. How are we doing there?
Not as well. We are ranked in the bottom third by different measures. If you look at just the numbers, we're at 36th In compared to the 50 states in Washington, D.C. If you look at a report that's put out by Education Weekly, we're 46th in the nation in per pupil spending.
That's near the bottom. I mean, California for a long time was kind of near the bottom in terms of per pupil spending. If there's more money now, so it's getting a little better, but we're still
very
bottom
much
10.
So. Yeah, and that's because of the regional cost differences, just what it costs to live in California.
Is also what's driving that, you know, what's the breakout of that? So we have high teacher salaries, yet low per pupil spending. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that means larger classrooms.
Exactly. We, if you look at what's happening is we don't, you could argue that we don't invest enough in education, that we score low, if you look at the Quality Counts report, when it comes to how much taxable resources as a state that we spend on education.
It's kind of amazing. When you take a look at the state budget, about 40% of the state budget goes to K-12 and community college education. That is a sizable chunk. I think that surprises a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people think, oh, the majority of state spending is on corrections or something like that. That's not the case at all, is it?
No, and that's largely due to Proposition 98, which sets a guarantee for school funding. It's very much a protection measure for schools.
And that's a pretty complicated measure. And Prop 98, I mean, we can get into that, I suppose, but that's a very complicated measure in terms of how schools get their financing, but it's mandated, isn't it?
It is. We passed it in 1988, and it's a complex formula, but the thrust of it is easy. It's just to make sure that we're adequately supporting schools and community colleges.
Yeah, the thrust of it is easy, but the devil is in the details, right? Well, thank you for that overview of education spending in California. Up next, despite low per pupil spending, public education still commands a lion's share of the state budget, as we discussed. Where's that money coming from? Next on the Mattie Report. Welcome back. We're speaking with Judy Lin, a reporter with Cal Matters, who recently wrote a series of articles on the price of education in California. You know, as noted earlier, California schools are experiencing a dramatic growth in revenue, but where is all this money coming from? Clearly part of this is Prop 30, as we talked about a little earlier. It's had a big impact on state funding for schools. So first, can you remind our audience exactly what the voters approved when they approved Prop 30?
Sure. If you remember, 2012 was a big year. We're still reeling from the recession. Governor Brown went up and down the state across school campuses and campaigned for what was Proposition 30. The premise was simple. It was a temporary tax. We raised the sales tax by a quarter cent. And then we also increased the personal income tax for 7 years on high income earners. That, and it was a progressive model, went from $250,000 to $1 million at progressively higher rates.
Yeah. And the sales tax, though, someone argues that's kind of a regressive tax. It falls more harshly, you could say, on lower income people than higher income people. It's a bigger part of their mm-hmm. disposable income. So that phased out after 4 years. And then we've got the income tax part of it's going to be going on for a few more years. Then that's eventually going to phase out. How much money was that bringing in?
Sure. Together, the two pots brought in about $8 billion more a year, which is about $1.5 billion came from the sales tax. And this 2016 is the last year we'll have that in effect. About $6 or $7 billion is coming from the personal income tax. And you'll see that starting to phase out by the end of 2018.
Yeah, it's interesting. California, their revenue structure really is focused on personal income taxes. I think about two-thirds of the state's revenue comes from personal income taxes, a lot. And a lot of that, frankly, is on high wage earners.
Yeah.
Not high wage earners, that's actually a mistake probably. It's on people who have capital gains, stock market, that kind of thing, where they're selling stocks, and they pay a lion's share of it. So obviously, the improving economy has had a big impact on generating revenue there. But you were saying $8 billion. It's interesting, you know, that figure, we were running about $6 to $8 billion deficits mm-hmm. when this thing came in, and all of a sudden we're no longer a deficit. And really, a lot of people can point to Prop 30.
Yes,
that's probably the reason why we're not running deficits. At least weren't before. Yeah. Now we're running surpluses. So let's talk about the improving economy, the impact it's had on school funding because of Prop 98's minimum guarantee. I don't want to get too much into the weeds on Prop 98. We did a show earlier on Prop 98, and someone was saying that the person who designed it actually put his kids through college explaining Prop 98. It's so complicated. Winchester Mystery House, for those of people who drive to the Bay Area and see that on Route 152. So what is Prop 98? How does that exactly work, that minimum guarantee work?
It is a formula that sets an annual funding level for K-12 schools and community colleges. It's determined by three measures, and the goal of it is to track with the growth of the economy and with the number of students. So that's the really basic premise.
And there's all kinds of complicated formulas, though, to make that happen, right?
Yes, yeah, three test cases. One is a percentage of the general fund, one is the percentage of the economy, and I may get it wrong.
Yeah, well, and there's a number of things. The bottom line is you better be a math major if you're going to put this together, because it's extremely complicated. And the other thing, too, is interesting, is that it's based on past revenues, right? So let's say in the previous year you had a good revenue stream, but now in the next year you don't. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. You've got to be paying based on what you received coming in prior. So that just... it makes it very, very challenging. In addition to this new funding, though, there's a new set of policies that's been adopted to improve academic outcomes. First of all, I was wondering, how big are the academic differences between various ethnic and racial groups? Is it a big divide?
Very much so. There's what a lot of educators call the academic achievement gap. This is where you see Latinos and African American students on standardized testing, having less proficiency and not passing compared to white students. In the latest, most recent batch of standardized mm-hmm. tests, less than 1 in 4 low-income and Latino children and less than 1 in 5 African-American children scored high enough to be proficient in math.
20-25% mm-hmm. means, 75-80% are not proficient.
Yeah.
Those are big numbers. So states tried to address this problem by introducing something called the Local Control Funding Formula, LCFF, a lot easier to write it that way. What is the Local Control Funding Formula? How does it address that imbalance?
Sure. The idea is that we are dramatically throwing out our previous model, where the state was very much dictating how to school district how you should spend your money. But Governor Brown, in his effort to push things to the local level, wanted to give discretion to districts. So he created this formula, and it basically is doles out a base amount to every school, and on top of that, if it gives additional funds.
So if you have low income or English as a second language, you get a little bump.
Yes.
Extra money. Yeah, it's interesting. The previous way they did it is they actually earmarked the funds. This money's for this money's for that. Now they're saying use it for whatever you think is appropriate. Apparently, school districts then can use it for whatever they want. They don't even have to report back to the state as to how they're spending the money. There's a question, is that money getting into those classrooms that need that money?
We don't know, and that is definitely a red flag. As San Diego Assemblywoman Shirley Weber is saying, we can hope that the intent of it is good. But given that it's a new formula, it's only been in a year or two, we don't know what measurable results. Right. And keep in mind, Governor Brown, in his maintaining his philosophy on local control, right, doesn't necessarily want to know.
Yeah, so that's going to be very interesting. Wow, thank you for that explanation of education funding in California. So up next, how are those education dollars actually being spent? Do we really know? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. With California's school budget up more than 50%, why are educators saying that they're having difficulty balancing their budgets going forward? We're talking with Judy Lin, a reporter with Cal Matters, who's written extensively on the price of education in California. So educational administrators are pointing to unfunded pension liability. How big is the unfunded pension liability in K-12 education?
Yeah, at the last marker from last June was $67 billion for unfunded pension liabilities. And this is for about 880,000 currently active and retired teachers and administrators, certified employees.
It's interesting. Pensions are supposed to be actuarially sound. So actuarially sound. I'll make sure I say that correctly. You know, the money coming in is supposed to be enough to pay for the things going out. How did the system, the teachers' retirement system, get so out of whack?
It was built up over years when the economy was doing well. The state and local school districts basically didn't contribute as much because we were actuarially sound. The economy, the stock markets, their investments were showing strength and
so we figured that would go on forever.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen. If anybody invests in the stock market with a 401k, they know it goes up and down.
Mm-hmm.
There was an agreement in 2014 with the governor and the legislature on how to eliminate this debt over the next 30 years. What was in that agreement?
Yeah, so Governor Brown and lawmakers passed this long-term payment plan, and it ramps up the school district contributions from 8.25% of payroll to 19.1%.
Whoa, that almost doubles
it. So it's more than double.
And, yeah. And that's by 2020, so,
yes.
So that's a big jump. They better have money set aside for that. Not so much the teachers themselves?
The teachers themselves are going up, but it ends up being capped, and the state also is increasing its contributions, but largely this is falling on school districts.
Okay, so what does that mean for the school district's bottom line?
It means that with all the extra money they've been getting from Proposition 30, it's going out to, it's being set aside to make sure they can pay for these benefits that have been promised to teachers.
Yeah, my understanding is, because reading the LAO report, Legislative Analyst Report, says that the Prop 98 minimum guarantee would bring in about $8.3 billion more by the time this kicks in 2020. So, but a good chunk of that, $3 billion of that, is going to be paying for this unfunded liability. So a pretty big chunk.
Yeah, 38% my finding.
Yeah, they're not getting that whole $8 billion. They're going to only get a portion of that.
Mm.
You've written that the situation actually may be worse than that. You're saying that there is a high return on investment assumed with the money being set aside for the pension fund for investments. Can you explain?
Yeah. So the pension system, they project out, there are assumptions of how much their investments will raise and in interest. And
so the idea behind the system is we're going to put some money aside to pay for the retirement, but we're also going to invest that money. And so that investment income will also pay. So the overall cost won't be so much on the retiree.
Yeah. And it's a 7.5% assumption rate in the California teachers.
So they're assuming a 7.5% return on investment on those pension funds.
Yes, yes.
Sounds pretty good. I think a lot of people would like to get 7.5% on their return.
Their 20-year return has been above that, but they are moving to be more cautious. The CalSTRS, the Teachers Retirement System Board, is considering whether or not they should make adjustments to that.
But when they lower the rate of return, assumed, that means they're going to have to ask people to put more money in to make up that difference, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, well, in school districts, so then even a bigger hit. Which
yes.
is what your point. I think the point is of your article.
Yes.
Wow. So there's also add another problem to the mix here, and that's the issue of retiree health care. How big a problem is that, and is there any money being set aside to deal with those future obligations? So it's not just the pension, it's also the retiree health.
Yeah, so there was a recent report by State Controller Betty Yee that pegged the whole state cost for retiree health and dental benefits at $74 billion.
That's everybody.
All state workers. But to put it in perspective, the state is setting aside $1.29 billion,
mm-hmm.
and she's saying they should actually be putting aside $5 billion.
Wow.
So
20% of what they should be setting aside, 80% is not being covered.
Because of our pay-as-you-go system.
Right.
That we have.
Right. Well, thank you. That's a good picture of the current obligations and how they may determine how education dollars are going to be spent in the future. Up next, Prop 30's temporary tax planned to end by 2020. Will it be needed to be extended to ensure adequate education funding in the future? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. Governor Brown has been warning about an economic downturn for some time. If a recession were to occur, what impact would it have on school funding? We're talking to Judy Lin with Cal Matters about the price of education in California. Although the governor and the legislative analyst are not forecasting an economic slowdown. You just got to look at the numbers. And over the last five recessions, economic recoveries lasted about 68 months. Well, in February of 2016, we're at that 68th month. So the question is, you know, if we get a recession or some kind of economic downturn, what impact is that going to have on school funding?
Yeah, that line that you think of a chart keep going up, it's going to go down and then maybe recover a little bit so you end up maybe flat. The Legislative Analyst Office has done a projection to 2019, and they're saying if we go into a recession, the education budget will dip down and then end up right back at $71 billion, which is where we are now.
Right, right. Okay, so not surprisingly, school groups like the California Teachers Association, the California Federation of Teachers, the state PTA, a lot of them, are pushing for an extension of those Prop 30 temporary taxes that are scheduled to expire. So what exactly are they proposing and how much money would it generate?
Yeah, so they definitely want to let the sales tax portion expire. They think that the burden...
Because that impacts everyone.
Yeah.
As opposed to the higher income tax that only impacts higher income people.
They think they can get more votes that way.
That is usually what happens with taxes, isn't it, right? I mean, tobacco tax. If it affects someone else, I'm going to vote for it. If it affects me, maybe not so much. How much is that going to generate if it passed?
Yeah, and so it's very much an extension of what the governor had done in Prop 30. And so it would just continue to bring in, you know, maybe $8 billion more a year. And most of that would go to schools.
Yeah, it's serious money. In the billions, what if the tax isn't extended? Then what?
Then we're very much at the whim of the economy, you know, because of our volatile budget structure. It will...
A heavy reliance on capital gains, right? Because a big reliance on personal income tax, particularly at the higher levels, and that's capital gains. And so if the stock market goes down, there goes the revenue.
Yes.
Is that basically the problem?
That's basically it.
So let's say we have a double whammy. There is no extension of the Prop 30 temporary taxes, mm-hmm. And there's a recession. Then what?
Then we take that double hit. It's about the way we did some forecasting and projections based on LAO numbers is we're looking at a difference of $12 billion. And that's, you know, a good 16%, if not more, of our current spending on education.
A $12 billion hit.
Yeah.
Wow. So what do you think? Do you think that this extension is going to get on the November ballot? And what do you think the chances are that it'll actually pass?
That is up to the voters. I would never claim to know the mood of the voters. But it is headed for the ballot in November.
Okay.
It's a crowded ballot, but it will be on there. You have a wide coalition of teachers unions, parent groups, even hospitals and doctors are on board. So they're out collecting signatures.
But they've
got to
collect 585,000 signatures by June 30th.
Yes. So, and get it cleared and validated.
Okay, but the point is too that do you think they'll do it? You think they're actually going to hit that target?
Yes, yes, it's very doable.
But there's some opposition out there. This is not going to sail through. The governor, for example, has said that the current proposal has a fatal flaw, that it doesn't have the state's rainy day fund as part of the equation. Is that going to tube this? Is that going to send it down into flames?
No. So in the campaign genius, the organizers of this tax extension went in and modified their rainy day proposal to make Brown happy. It now sets aside money as he intended into the rainy day.
And it's also going to be a presidential election year, higher voter turnout, typically more Democrats vote, and then maybe have a better chance of passing. Let me ask you a last issue about school construction. There was recently a $9 billion bond proposal that's being floated. The governor seems to oppose that as well. Why does the governor oppose that?
He is very much of the mindset that the program is flawed. It's not that he doesn't support construction. It's that the way it is constructed allows the more well-organized, affluent districts to get...
Because they've already got things in the pipeline, on the shelf, ready to go, and the poor districts don't. Is that basically the problem?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Judy Lynn from Cal Matters for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or log on to our website at MattyInstitute.org and sign up for Matty Daily, our free e-newsletter. This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, how is the cost of education impacting Valley schools? We'll talk to Dr. Todd Odo, the superintendent of the Visalia Unified School District, and Michael Johnston, the associate superintendent of administrative services for the Clovis Unified School District.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Welcome back. School districts across the Valley have seen a significant increase in state funding. A good portion of it is targeted to those local school districts who have a large numbers of economically disadvantaged and ESL, English as a second language, students. How is that money being spent, and is it making a difference in closing the education achievement gap? We're joined by some educators to talk about that and other things. We have Dr. Todd Odo, the superintendent of the Visalia Unified School District, and his team. Welcome, Dr. Odo.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
And Michael Johnston, the associate superintendent of administrative services at the Clovis Unified School District. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
So, Dr. Odo, let me start with you first. In an earlier segment of the show, we were discussing about the significant increase in state education funding. I'm just wondering, in a district like yours, how much of that have you been seeing in the last 5 years? Have those percentages really increased?
Yeah, the answer is yes. But for more specifics, I'm going to hand off to our chief financial officer, Nathan Hernandez.
Yeah, in Visalia Unified, over the last 5 years, we've seen an increase of about 45% in our revenues from the state. And that's because of the passage of Proposition 30 several years ago, which is a temporary tax measure. We've seen our state revenues go from $162 million a year to about $235 million a year projected for next year.
Wow, that's quite a big jump. Are you seeing the same thing in Clovis, Michael?
Well, it's much different because of the disadvantaged students you mentioned. And really what we looked at is, in preparing for this and discussing it, is looking at the increase in our base funding that we're getting to really maintain our operational budgets of what we do in the school district, because the new formula has three components to it: base, a supplemental, and a concentration. Well, there's a big advantage to being a concentration district, which means you're over 55% free and reduced. You get additional
free
funds
and reduced
for that.
So people can use this term all the time.
Low economic disadvantaged
students.
So
lunch, free lunches is what you're talking about.
Yes, okay. Exactly. So, you know, when you get that concentration grant, you get 50% more on top of your base grant from what you're getting on those unduplicated students of free and reduced for your school district. So that's a significant pot of money that we don't get to play in Clovis Unified. When we look at new dollars for Clovis Unified, we, you know, on the average in the last 5 years, it's probably an increase of less than 3% for us on our operational dollars for the school district. So the base grant is not that significant amount to really go home and brag about.
So it's pretty small, I mean, relative to what some other districts that have a higher proportion of these low-income students are getting.
Yeah, exactly. We've done some analysis, too, in looking at other school districts just in Fresno County. And we are the lowest-funded school district in Fresno County as far as when you look at the LCFF formula.
And local control funding formula.
I'll try to stop with those acronyms. I know they're bad. But when you look at school districts in Fresno County, the unified school districts, if we were just to get the average of what other unified school districts got in Fresno County, our district would see $90 million more per school year from getting the average. So we're way off of the average for Clovis Unified.
That was
great things, but we don't get the same funding.
Yeah, that was a big issue going forward. I mean, I think a lot of people realize that the challenges of poor school districts, they certainly have challenges and they certainly need probably additional funding. The question is how much?
Yep.
And then some of the districts like Clovis Unified, which don't have a large proportion of those low-income students, are saying, gee, that's a little bit of a – we're getting 3% and other districts are getting quite a bit more. So that is kind of been a discussion for some time now, I think.
Yeah, and it's hard because we have those same students in our school district too. I mean, we don't have as many of them, but we have the same students.
Right. I think we're making that argument that we've been hearing for a while under the local control funding formula. But let me ask you this. So you're talking about base funding and the local control funding formula. Do you get any money under the local control funding formula in Clovis?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's the base grant that's part of it. We get the supplemental part of it, which is 20% of the base grant we get for those students that are free and reduced, but we don't get the other portion. It's a pretty large piece of the pie.
So, but a lot of districts are, well, the districts are being asked to create these things called local control and accountability plans. I'm wondering, has Clovis Unified done that? And how are they spending that money? How have they decided to spend that money?
Oh, yeah, we've done a lot of work. You know, that's processing with our parent groups, reaching out to all of our constituents to make sure, we, you know, what are we developing in our plan? We've done a lot of work on our plans for the local control accountability program. We've created a transition program through the LCAP process, local control accountability program. We've got feedback from parents and students to create that transition program.
So the parents are actually coming in and saying, here's where we'd like to see the money spent.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Here's the areas we process with our community to see what are the needs within our community. What are we doing well and what do we need to improve upon? So we've had those discussions.
Can you elaborate in terms of what people are saying in terms of where that money ought to be spent?
Yeah, I mean, like what I was saying, the transition programs, helping out those needier students as far as how do we help them transition? How do we provide some more bilingual support for students that need that bilingual support? So we've been doing a lot of that, you know, with parent involvement. You know, also we're, you know, creating parent academies to help support parents and their involvement and success in our school district. So things like that that really reach out to the community.
You know, that is so important that parents stay involved. I mean, my child happens to go to Clovis Unified, and I've actually gone into the classroom and helped the teacher and the parents help the teachers. And you can really see the difference in students whose parents are involved and those that aren't.
Oh, yeah.
It's night and day. Because one thing you do if you're a parent and helping the teacher, they have you look at the assignments, the homework assignments that are supposed to be reviewed by the parent in their folders. And some folders that you can see, they've never been looked at.
Yeah.
Other folders, they got all kinds of markings by the parent or – You know they've been looked at. And then you start talking to the student and you realize, boy, they're really behind because the parents really aren't that involved. So parent responsibility is a big thing. But Dr. Odo, let me ask you about at Visalia Unified School District. I assume, getting some money out of this local control funding formula, and you've created this local control and accountability plan. What kinds of things are you guys focusing on?
Yeah. It really kind of mirrors what Clovis has done, and I think we need to go back for just a second. When we say local control, we really do mean that. There was a group put together to collect information from across our community with regard to the interests and needs of the community. So we talked to parents, we talked to local business, local community leaders to see what the priorities were. And then we worked from that information and also through the state's eight priority areas. And the eight priority areas ranged everywhere from implementing the new state standards to providing more parent involvement and engagement, and also looking at school climate. So the approach under LCAP specifically is looking at the whole child, and that's really that's the most significant thing, I think, in the change in the funding here. So instead of focusing simply on academic development of children, focusing on professional development of teachers to support that, which we still do under LCAP, we're looking also at things like parent involvement, like Clovis has just described, workshops for parents so they can understand how to access the system and how to tutor their kids, looking at developing parent advocacy within our system. We're looking at parent outreach. We, for example, one of our major initiatives was hiring community liaisons, support staff at individual schools at our elementary level to make strong connections with parents in issues related to connecting with school and also with improving student attendance. We've also looked deeply at issues related to school culture. So, for example, decreasing the number of suspensions and expulsions on individual school sites and across the district. We've been successful with that. Also, in parallel with the work with SAFES, increasing student attendance. And again, deep, deep, deep professional development across the district at all levels to make sure that we can carry out the mission of the district through the new funding here. The other thing we need to point out here as well is that we're coming out of a time when money's been really, really tight. So some of the things that we've done under LCFF and LCAP is restoration of program that we valued before and held on to as long as we could, but had to cut during the recession.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It used to be when the state gave money, they gave it with strings attached, right? And they used to call these things categoricals. And they said, okay, here's the money, and you got to use it specifically for this purpose. I'm thinking, Dr. Odo, you kind of like the fact that you get to decide where to spend that money.
Absolutely. You know, again, to go back to my original point there, we are accountable to the people that we see in the line at SaveMart. We're accountable to the people that we work with in the community. We're accountable to the folks that we live with. And that does two things for us. Number one, it makes our work much more closely tied to the needs and interests of the folks in our community. And at the same time, what it does is it heightens our awareness of what it is that we're actually involved in here. Previously, you know, accountability meant some folks would come in from the state every couple of years, and you'd do a thing, and they'd review paper, and you'd talk to them because everybody knew the lingo, and you could do things that were really not inappropriate, but that were all done within the context of education ease. Now we have to be extraordinarily transparent and make sure that what we do translates well to the community, certainly supports kids, and works to the common good at a very, very close eyeball-to-eyeball level.
You know, I want to ask you, Dr. Odo, about this achievement gap between various ethnic and racial groups. I mean, what the research generally shows is that on recent standardized tests, less than a quarter of low-income or Latino students and less than a fifth of African-American children score high enough to be considered proficient in math. About when you compare it to whites, about half whites are proficient and about two-thirds of Asians are considered proficient. So there is this big achievement gap. And the question is, what kind of strategies is your district using to kind of address that concern? What are your most successful strategies?
Yeah, well, we have the same issue at Visalia. So what we work on are a couple things. And the biggest grouping we've got here at Visalia is English learners. So what we do there is we do professional development so the teachers can use best possible strategies and do best possible first instruction with English learners. We have an intervention program that's developed over the last couple of years, and it's becoming much more refined this year, the coming year, to provide support as close to the kids and with the kids as we can in the classroom. We're also looking at intervention from the perspective of student behavior and going into mental health-related services and support. Because, again, when we look at the whole kid, it's not just about this kid, that math score, working on the traditional things. We have to go broader. That's also where the parent involvement comes in. You want to circle as many resources as you can around an individual kid in his or her situation to close that gap kid by kid. In the past, what we've done is we've looked at achievement gap issues at the population level. This local control accountability forces us to look at it at the very, very smallest level, individual kids.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, obviously, which I think what you're saying is it's not scores alone. So, Michael, I want to ask you at Clovis Unified, do you think it's fair? How do you judge whether or not this additional money to K through 12 is actually a good investment? Should we just be focusing on scores alone, or are there other things you should be focusing on?
Well, I'd say test scores alone aren't the only means of measuring student success. Generally, test scores indicate whether students have mastered or learned the skills and knowledge needed for each grade or course that they take. Successful students are also those that are prepared for and enter into the world college career market. You know, what are they doing there? How successful have they been? Other measures include involvement in school, understanding civic responsibility. You know, the whole child is really what we're looking at and processing and moving forward to that. You know, what we've always said, mind, body, and spirit. It's that whole child and what are they going to do in the future.
You almost opened up a segue to discuss dress code, but I'm not going there.
Thank you.
Dr. Otto, I'm going to kind of transition to something else, and that is the impact of vocational and technical education at Visalia Unified School District. Are you spending a lot of money on vocational and technical education at Visalia Unified?
Absolutely. This is a new golden age for career technical education in California. So we're spending more money on program, but there's also more money available. So above and beyond what we've been able to do through LCFF and LCAP, there have also been a couple of private initiatives related to, for example, Link Learning Academies, which is a program we offer on our high schools that allow kids to work in integrated programs, combining core and CTE programs together in a four-year program. And also incentive grant funds from the state that have rolled out for the last year or two. So there's lots and lots of really, really good stuff going on in vocational education that does two things. Number one, it reinforces the value of the traditional programs that we've long had in place in Visalia. We've kept those things through the economic downturn, and now we can really rebuild them, refocus them, and make them much more relevant. It's also allowed us to look to develop CTE-related programs in new ways. Again, that's like Link Learning Academies. That's new and innovative ways to bring services very closely to kids and surround them with the kinds of motivation and support that allows them to be successful through high school and long beyond.
Yeah, I want to ask Michael at Johnson at Clovis Unified about the same thing, about vocational and technical education. Is Clovis Unified putting an increased emphasis on that these days?
Oh, yeah, we have for quite some time, as I'm sure many people realize that, you know, we've created facilities even at Buchanan, our energy education building, where we're creating learning about renewable resources, Over at Clovis High School, you know, we have a building program where they're learning how to build and construct and do different things. So we've identified each high school that has a specific vocational area that they'll focus in and support
That's
kids
interesting. I want you to kind of, because in case people miss that point, go back over that point again. Each high school has a specific area?
Oh, yeah. Buchanan's our renewable energy high school. They're focusing on renewable energy. Clovis High, as I mentioned, the building program. Clovis East is our ag program, you know, looking at the ag.
Don't you have a health
energy
program, too?
Health program is at Clovis North. And Clovis West is our automotive program. So they're very specific, but they're available for the kids to participate in.
So Clovis has been doing this for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, up next, what about this new teacher shortage? Will it mean more pressure on school district budgets in the Valley as they try to attract new teachers with higher pay and better benefits? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking about the increasing price of education and whether Valley schools can afford it with Dr. Todd Odo, the superintendent of the Visalia Unified School District, and Michael Johnston, the associate superintendent of administrative services at Clovis Unified School District. So, Dr. Odo, let me start this segment with you. We're beginning to hear a lot about teacher shortages, and I'm wondering, is that the case in your district?
Yeah, we are struggling to find highly qualified teachers for all of our classrooms. We've done a really good job in that, actually, and we're starting, as you say here, we're starting to see this shortage come across. To go a little bit deeper with that, I'm going to refer over to our Assistant Superintendent for Human Resources, Tamara Ravelin.
Hi. We are seeing some shortages, specifically in special education, math, science, and English. What we're experiencing, I think, is very similar throughout the state and in many states across the nation right now.
Yeah. I'm wondering at Clovis Unified, Michael, you see the bills that go by and the cost, but you're dealing with the budget all the time. Are you seeing the higher teacher pay? You're going to need that to attract new teachers to Clovis Unified?
That's something that's really interesting as we all try to compete for the same teachers in the same area. You know, it's just a challenge for us all. They're looking at, you know, how do we provide the best packages? We've coined our district as, you know, really looking at the whole package. It's not just pay. It's where you work. It's the people you work with. It's the kids you work with. It's the culture of the school district, the culture of any organization. You know, great organizations are built on great cultures. So,
which is interesting, you know, too. I mean, Clovis Unified, if I'm not mistaken, is the largest school district in California that's non-union. The teachers are non-union. Yeah, and most districts, almost virtually every other district, they are unionized. So that's interesting, just the play of that in terms of what Clovis Unified has to do to attract teachers. I'm assuming they got to provide a compensation and benefits package that's pretty similar, if you're going to attract those kinds of teachers.
Yeah, we all struggle for those teachers. I think it's a nationwide problem of teacher shortage. I've been to different areas that comment that they're struggling to get teachers. So it's not unnatural. I think, you know, what we try to do, too, is grow our own. You know, students become teachers in our school district. About 38% of our new hires were actually graduates of Clovis Unified School District.
38%?
So, yeah.
That's a large number.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how that would compare to other districts. Do you have any idea, Dr. Odo, I'm just calling you the spot here, any idea of how many of your teachers came from Visalia Unified?
Couldn't say offhand.
Not a specific number, but a large number of recruits are Visalia Unified graduates, especially people who've maybe thought they were going to move out of the Valley for a while and then decided they wanted to come home to raise their families. We go to recruitment fairs up and down the state, and we meet people from the Valley, and they're thrilled to get back.
Isn't that common? It's so amazing. I need to get out of home. I need to leave the Valley. And then two or three years later, I want to come home. So
yeah.
I think they have to leave and see what they're missing and then come back. Michael, let me ask you this. State allocations are up for a lot of school districts, about 50% different, obviously, at Clovis Unified, because you're not getting some of that money because of the way your district, the demographics of your district. But you're hearing a lot from educators about the difficulty they're going to have in balancing budgets going forward. And I'm thinking a lot of that has to do with retiree benefits, things like unfunded pension liability and retiree health care costs. Is that a challenge for Clovis Unified?
Well, I think it's all a challenge in how you approach it. You know, have you planned for it? And we're obviously planning for those adjustments. And those as we look at our budget, we look at a multi-year projection. That's a six-year-out projection to really get a handle on all those pieces of the puzzle. But it's not just pensions. It's, it's a loss of Prop 30 funding. If that Prop 30 funding goes away, a quarter cent sales tax that's going away in 2016, that generates $1.5 billion for the state of California. You know, if those dollars go away, how is that going to affect our educational program? Those are factors we have to include. And then later on in 2018, the personal income tax for the higher income earners goes away. So,
right, because Prop 30 basically had two parts to it. One was a sales tax that sunsets in 2016.
Correct.
And then an income tax on higher income people that sunsets in 2018
for right. individuals earning over $250,000 and married couples earning over $500,000.
Good news, I don't have to worry about that.
Well, the good news about that tax, too, is for the Valley, that's actually a pretty good tax because, you know, our area is going to really benefit from that where other areas are going to pay more into that tax.
Right,
so,
right. It's a tax. I like the tax because someone else is paying for it.
Yeah, exactly.
But that actually brings up a good point, Dr. Odo, and that is, you know, the financial situation in the near term for most school districts seems to be pretty good. But as Michael's mentioning, you know, there's pressures that are building that may cause a change. One of them is this loss of Prop 30 funding. What if that happens? What if Prop 30 is not ripped? And it was supposed to be. It was sold as a temporary tax. But there are certainly lots of groups, teachers groups, even you know, some employer groups like the Chamber that probably you know are thinking about supporting this, an extension. What are your thoughts if Prop 30 is not extended in some manner or fashion? What does that mean to Visalia Unified in terms of the programs and things that it offers?
Well, it's going to have significant impact, certainly, because we've built around that. I'm going to hand off back to Nathan Hernandez for his insight.
Yeah, I think you know we've been here before, not very long ago, and it doesn't, you know, there's the scars there and bad memories, so. We were able to get through that, though, because we were able to build a reserve within our general fund. There has been some legislation that would reduce our reserve. Thankfully, that the triggers haven't been met yet, so we do still have a reserve. And so in another downturn, we would use that to kind of soften the landing.
Yeah, didn't the governor talk about, I think they did implement a cap on what school districts could maintain in their reserve?
Yeah, they did implement that, but there's some triggers that have to be met before the cap has been enacted. So those haven't been met yet.
Okay, Michael, I'm wondering at Clovis Unified, I'm sure you're anticipating that Prop 30 will go away and nothing will replace it. What are your contingency plans?
Well, we've built our budget and future year projections based off, you know, those dollars going away. So we've planned on that. We've made adjustments. You know, other big things I think we need to, it's not just Prop 30, it's also other expenditures that come to us too. Minimum wage is going to be something that will impact school districts that aren't paying the minimum wage, you know, we're going to struggle to pay that increased minimum wage.
If they're talking moving to the minimum wage to say $15 an hour,
exactly.
That's going to have a big impact, I would think, on school budgets.
That goes pretty deep into the salary schedule. You know, we have a lot of classified employees that are paid under that $15 per hour.
So maintenance people who work in the cafeteria,
mm-hmm.
things of that nature.
Oh, yeah.
And that adds up. Well, let me transition to another issue that's kind of been in the news lately, and that is a $9 billion bond proposal for school construction on the November ballot. It's interesting that the governor's come out in opposition to this proposed $9 billion bond proposal. What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
Well, this is another one, just kind of the same situation for the Valley. This is a good thing for the state of California. Having a bond that supports schools is huge for us because other areas that are more well-to-do in the state of California actually contribute towards that bond a little bit more than we do. For Clovis Unified, I mean, it's significant because it means we can continue having great facilities, which is really helping the educational environment of our students. That bond would generate about $90 million for our school district.
Just for Clovis Unified alone.
Just for Clovis Unified alone. And those dollars are going to come back into the community. They're going to come back into business in the community and people that work in the community. There's a ripple effect to all those dollars coming into our community and supporting the Valley.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Visalia Unified, what are your thoughts about this $9 billion bond for school construction that they're thinking about?
And I'm going to hand off to Assistant Superintendent for Admin Services, Robert Graber. He's been waiting all day to answer this question.
Okay. Well, go for it.
I have. I've been excited to jump on my soapbox. And just like Michael and Clovis, you know, we were able to pass a local bond back in 2012. And we applied for state reimbursement under the rules of the time. And this bond would allow us, just like Clovis Unified, to leverage about $75 million in reimbursements to come back to us to complete our bond lift from that bond measure. So it's extremely important for us to be able to complete the lift that we pledged to our public. In addition, because we're a growing district and we're thankful for that, We're building our next elementary school on anticipated developer fees and of actually borrowing from our general fund in order to meet the needs of our growing community. So we expect that that reimbursement is very important for us, too, to continue our elementary school growth to match our growth. I think it's important for us to look at that success in November of 16 for this state bond as we look to our fifth high school. You know, without that money being available to us as a state match, there isn't any way that our community would be able to support the entire cost of a fifth high school.
Well, I've got some good news for both of you. The Public Policy Institute of California did a poll in December, a little while ago, but the most recent poll on this issue said 54% of likely voters favor an extension of Prop 30, so that you might get some money there, and maybe then it might fall into the bond. The other issue going on in the November election, if this thing hits the November ballot, is there's going to be a large turnout. And usually in those situations, it's probably more Democrats and probably more likely to support a bond proposal. So there may be a silver lining in the November election for both districts. Well, I want to thank our guests, Dr. Todd Otto, the superintendent of Visalia Unified School District, and Michael Johnston, the associate superintendent of administrative services for the Clovis Unified School District. Thanks both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.